We're going to do a very short prayer. It's in the beginning of your notebook. We'll do mandala offering first, and then we'll do the taking refuge. That's the subject of this course. So the last part of the course will be a death meditation, how to do a death meditation, which is not so much of the scary thing of trying to replicate what's going to happen when you die. It's thinking of all the reasons why it's certain that you're going to die, you don't know when you're going to die, and what kinds of things in the world can help you when you die. How many things are there in the world that can be any use to you when you die? Because basically the day you die, everything you have here becomes pretty meaningless to you. You know, you no longer, 30 seconds after you die, you don't care about your house or your job or your kids or anything. You're in a totally different existence. You're totally on your own. Pretty much your mind is wiped pretty clean. And your whole life will be totally different. You won't recognize yourself at all to be what you are now. So the idea is that we should get ready for that. We should know what could happen. You have to understand what's going to happen and then try to do the best we can to prepare for that, because it will come. So it's just a question of who goes first and then who goes second and then we'll all go. So it's some kind of trying to study from people who have been there, who can see those things, what's going to happen when you die. And what can you do about it? So really, the last part of the course will be a death meditation by a great Tibetan Lama called Desam Katha. And the first part of the course, we're going backwards actually, are all the locations where you can end up after you die. So we're going to go through the whole realms of sentient life. You know, where are living beings? Where do they live? What do they look like? What are the realms that we can see? What are the realms that we can't see? And then after that, we'll do death meditation, which is how to get ready and how to avoid certain realms and how to steer yourself towards other realms. And then in between there, there'll be what's called the bardo, which means in between. And we'll be studying that. We'll be studying what's the bardo, what is it like. There's a lot of books out nowadays about the bardo. According to our lineage, some of them are just totally made up and incorrect. And so we're going to go straight to the original source of this teaching, which is called, or one of the original sources, called the Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma means higher knowledge. Abhi means higher. Dhamma means, in this case, knowledge. Abhidhamma. And the classic text, the text that's used in all Tibetan Buddhist monasteries, is Abhidhamma Kosha. Kosha means treasure house. And it's explained as being, the Abhidhamma Kosha is a book which includes a lot of the earlier teachings on Abhidhamma. So it's like a treasure house that contains all of that Abhidhamma knowledge. This is one of the five great books that this five-year course is all about. As a monk in the monastery, you try to memorize this text. It's about 150 pages long. And then you study the commentary of the first Dalai Lama. And you spend about, in the monastery you can spend 2 to 10 years on this. In New Jersey we spend 10 years on it. And it's a very great subject. This is a Hinayana text. It's according to the lesser vehicle. But we study it and we master it because it's correct and it's important, most of it. It was written when? Yeah, we estimate 350 AD, okay? About 16 centuries ago. All right? And it was written by a master named Vasubandhu was the brother of Sangha, who was between them, they wrote like three of the great books that are studied in Tibetan monasteries. They wrote more than half. And they were half brothers. So Vasubandhu is the author of this book, which is what we're going to be studying. We're going to be studying the third chapter, which is the presentation of the universe. Okay, the physical universe, who lives in it, what does it look like? Why do we get into this chapter? I mean, it's not very popular to teach this chapter in the West, because people say, oh, it has all these weird ideas about the shape of the world and things like that. It must be worthless. You know, it must be just this old Indian wrong idea of what the Earth was like before Sputnik went up. And they discovered what the Earth was really like, you know. And you have to talk about that. You know, most people just disregard this chapter. They get to the sexy part, which is the bardo, you know, the state between birth and death, and death and birth. And then they don't like the explanation that maybe the world is flat or the ocean is falling off the side of the earth or things like that. You know, that went out before Columbus, with Columbus. So why do we go through this? I mean, if you take the Abhidhamma Kosha, this book, Vasubandhu, it's very hard to read because it's full of these descriptions, for example, of what happens when you see emptiness directly. There's a long, long description of what's going on every millisecond during that experience. And then it gets into level upon level of spiritual realizations that you and I would be lucky to get to number one. It goes through hundreds of permutations, you know. It's a very confusing book. I mean, it's like describing some kind of country that you can't see and maybe you'll never see in this life. And it's fighting about, you know, what happens in this millisecond and what happens right after that, or can you have this thought after that, and can you emanate this, or maybe you can't emanate this, or it's very, very deep. So obviously the book was written by an incredibly realized person. So why does this incredibly realized person have a chapter about this ridiculous presentation of the world, you know? What's wrong with this guy? Did somebody add this chapter later? Or what's going on? That gets you into the emptiness of this world. I mean, this world, we assume that our perception of this world is the correct one. You know, we sent the guy up on a spaceship, that he took a camera with him, and now we know what the world looks like. And you assume that the world really looks like that, that 100 years from now, people will see the world the same way. Like, 1995, we decided the way the world looked. And we can actually take pictures down to a few square feet with our satellites, and therefore the world must look like that. But that's all dependent on your perceptions, and your perceptions can change. You will find out the day after you die. that the world can radically change. You know, the world that you thought was so fixed and so normal, and you are a human being and you're walking around the world, and the world must look like that. 30 seconds after you die, you're in a totally different world that you never dreamed existed. And there's many, many worlds like that. So, I mean, the definition of the world is a very fluid thing, and it depends greatly on your perceptions. Where those perceptions come from, you have to study karma. But basically, you are being forced by your past karma to experience this world in a certain way. It didn't have to be like that. And what I'm saying is, when you're a highly realized Buddhist master in 350 AD, maybe you see the world a certain way, and maybe you're correct. Maybe it's valid. Okay? Does that mean our perception of the world is invalid? No. You can have two valid perceptions of the same object that are different. Okay, that's quite possible. You know that we meet people at work. We always give this example, right? of the person that you truly feel is a bad person. According to your perceptions, this person is truly bad. And everybody in the office should understand it the way you understand it. If everybody had any brains, they would also see that this person is really bad. And then you run into somebody who thinks this person is really good. And they can give you good reasons why they think they're good. And then you wonder if you're talking about the same object. Or you hear, if you travel like to Asia, and you read Asian newspapers about something that happened, like I was in Thailand when Tiananmen Square happened. And the Thais are very afraid of the Chinese. So the whole thing in the newspapers was quite different. You know, the whole perception of that event was completely different. So it's quite possible that you have one event called a person, and that two different people can have totally different perceptions. One person can be perceiving this being as a tantric deity, validly. And another person can perceive this being as a petty, argumentative person. And they'll swear that that's what they are. And they'll struggle to say that that's the way the person really is. Actually, the person's just being forced by their past karma to see it that way. The person who's seeing that person as a tantric deity is being forced equally to see the person that way. The person is empty. That's one of the meanings of emptiness. The world is the same way. The person is a little microcosm. The world is a macrocosm. It's very possible that different beings have totally different perceptions of the same object called our world. So we're going to go through how Vasubandhu sees the world. Okay? Some of the parts of it, it's not important, I don't think. You know, whether there's nine mountains of iron 40 leagues from here to the north, I don't know, maybe not. You know. Is there a realm called hell? Is there a realm called the craving spirit? You know, are there other realms you could go to? That's an important question because we are, what? We're mortal, yeah. I mean, we have to be concerned about these questions. You know, if certain convincing arguments can be made, that it's very possible that you could have a perception called hell right after the air stops moving through these two holes. We have to study it. We have to check it out. So that's basically, we're going to go through that. It's an important subject. It's not just for some Buddhist scholarship, studying some ancient text that sounds weird, you know. It's a very important question that as we die, as each of us must, what will happen to us? Where will we go? Is this the only realm there is? Does the mind stop? We have a long class about that. So we're going to study the Abhidhamma question. There's another book. I'm going to put the Tibetan. You don't have to learn it. Someday you will. This won't be on your homework. I mean, you don't have to memorize the Tibetan for your homework. But you have to say the sounds real loud. Okay? Thailand? Thailand. 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 Okay. Tha stands for tarpa, which means what? Freedom. Okay? Moksha is a tarpa of publications, for example. Tarpa means, tar is short for freedom. Lam is like Lam Rim. What's Lam?
Path.
Yeah. Path. So Thai Lam is path to freedom. Sel means to make clear or illuminate. Sel J is an illuminator. So you could say a lamp. A lamp is called a Sel J. So it's as if we were blind people, or let's say it's dark outside, we're trying to get down the street and all the Indian restaurants are closed. And you can't follow the curry anymore. And you're going down the street and someone says, they bring a flashlight, they bring a lamp, and they walk you down the street. And this book is an illumination of the Abhidhamma Kosha. The Abhidhamma Kosha is in code. 나보람이 변신과 완전신과 미나로 나보람이 변신과 the five went towards the four 나보람이 변신과 완전신과 미나로 and the two relate to the three okay so and as a student in ancient India you memorize that 150 pages of that and then some lama would come and explain it to you and they explain the meaning of it by the time you get up to about the 15th century you have people writing books about the meaning because people can't memorize the way they used to memorize So Tarang Selje was written by
How would you translate the name,
Michael? I say illumination on the light of freedom. Or a path to freedom. Illumination of the path to freedom. Say Gyawa.
Gyawa.
Genin.
Genin.
Gyawa.
Gyawa.
Genin.
Genin.
Otherwise known as?
First Dalai.
First Dalai. Okay. He wasn't the first Dalai Lama before he died, but he got posthumous. It was like a bronze star posthumous. Gyawa Genin. He was the first Dalai Lama. I mean, the first of any of those lineages has to be extraordinary, like the first Panchen monk. They're very extraordinary people. And he wrote this text, The Illumination of the Path of Freedom, which is a commentary on the Abhidhamma Kosha. His dates are, I don't know, what are they? 1391. 1474?
Yes.
They thought they were going to have a quiz tonight. Okay. So, Gyawa means Gyawa means victor, victorious one, and it refers to a Buddha. So, Tibetans never call the Dalai Lama the Dalai Lama. They say Undun, which means the presence, or like that. Gyawa meaning the victorious one, meaning the victorious Buddha. Gyawa Rinpoche, precious victorious one, or something like that. They never call him Dalai Lama. That's a Mongolian name that was given later. So, he wrote the book that we're going to study. We're going to be studying selections from that. That's never been translated. And we're translating the readings. So you have it in your readings, and it's a very nice commentary to the Abhidhamma. Universe is made up of three parts, according to Buddhism. Okay? Say Dukkha.
Dukkha.
Dukkha. Dukkha means desire. Ka means realm. Dukkha is the desire realm. Okay? The desire realm. It's the lowest of the three realms. It's where we're presently parked. Okay? We're in the desire realm. Dukkha. Somebody opened a Tibetan store in New York called Dukkha. I think because all the objects there are very desirable. Say Sukham.
Sukham.
Sukham. Sukham means form. Kham means realm. Suk is defined as colors and shapes, basically. It can also be a more general term referring to the objects of the sense. But here it's mostly visible form. Okay, Sukham.
Form realm.
Yeah, form realm. And then the Sumekam. Say
Sumekam.
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 Sumekam. Okay. Suk means form again. Me means what?
No.
Yeah, less, okay? Formless realm. Okay. Me means not. So formless realm. Sumekam. So those are the three realms of samsara. Samsara means is a general word for suffering existence. There are beings who live but don't live in these three realms. They're out of samsara. They don't suffer the way we do. These three realms are defined by suffering. I mean, basically, if you're in one of these realms, you are suffering. If you're not in one of these realms, you're beyond suffering. You're out of suffering. So this is to be in this place or to be a being who lives in, to be either the place or the being who lives in the place is to suffer. Yeah.
So samsara is synonym for universe?
Not really. When you say samsara, it means suffering life in the sense of basically it's defined as having to die and get old. To be of the nature of having to die and get old. When you escape samsara or you reach nirvana, it's not like you have to run to some place. It's actually a change in your being. And then you've escaped cyclic life. So that's a long story. We won't bring it. Okay. Basically, these are the three realms of existence. In the first class we had back in January, we described the first two of these realms. So I'll go over them really quickly with you, and then we'll go on to a new realm. Okay, by the way, we also usually take a break in the middle because it helps you concentrate. towards the end of the class, which usually drags on. Okay? Dura means desire. Desire in the sense of the first Dalai Lama explains it as a special kind of desire. Desire meaning what do you call it? Like a desire for food or sex, basically.
Right.
The two main concerns of a being in the desire realm, or especially ours, we live in a realm which is almost defined by our food and sex, very gross physical sensations. And the dhu here can also refer to all the objects of the senses. Sometimes those are called dhu. So we're in a very, very gross realm where a lot of our life is spent looking, smelling, hearing, being attached to those objects. And we get attached to them. We struggle with other people in order to get them. We struggle with other people to get away from the ones we don't like. And it's almost all defined by desire for the objects of the senses. Very much of our existence in this realm is defined by some kind of desire for nice physical objects, and then wanting to get away from the objects we don't like. We are struggling in a sea of physical objects, and our lives and our conflicts in our lives are mainly defined by those desires for those objects. And we have that. That's why we're in the Durkheim. It's very interesting to say why are they called realms? You know, I mean, when I say realm, what do you think of? Yeah, you think of the king's realm, like his territory. So I know when I think of the three realms, it's like if I read a Buddhist book in English and it says the three realms, well, I always think, well, okay, I'm in this realm and it's kind of round like a ball, and there's probably a border there like a bubble. And if I break out, I'll get into the other realm. And then that's probably like some kind of big bubble. And then if I could walk across that realm, I could get through the next door and I'd be in the next realm. I mean, you think of realm. I think that's what pops into your mind. When I think of realm, it's like a big encasing thing. And then I could pop out and I'd be in another realm. And maybe there's trillions of those realms, but how many? Okay, well, Buddhism says there's three. But how do you travel between realms? And what is the border between the realms? I mean, in your mind, when you were a kid and they said heaven or hell, you thought of some, maybe a big wall. Like there's some fiction books that describe it as a big wall. If you climb over that wall, you're in another realm. I mean, what divides the realms? What sets one realm apart from another? How could you travel to another realm?
Your perception of estimates.
It's more like these are all suffering. These are all a bad place to be. And the way you travel between them is mental. And what it is that your mind enters a new level of subtlety. Like if you reach the point where you became a very, very heavy duty, deep meditator, and you were meditating most of the time, you would slowly lose. You've seen these, you know, Hindu skinny ascetic meditators who actually they don't eat much, they don't engage in any of the normal sensual pleasures. Their mind is on what they would call a higher plane, and they are existing in some kind of higher realm where they don't have any real interest in food. They don't care what restaurants there are in the East Village, you know. It's not interesting for them. They are totally absorbed in this kind of meditation where their mind is at a very, very subtle, fine point. And they take that to be an important spiritual thing. You know, they spend their lives trying to reach this level where their mind is at a very peaceful, blissed out, subtle existence. And that's their mind at the highest of that kind of practice, or very high kind of practice like that, maybe 1 in 1,000 people, 1 in 10,000 people, can reach a level in this life called the form realm. That is the form realm. Their mind is in the form realm. Their body is in the desire realm. But they just crossed the border. I mean, it wasn't like going up a ladder or getting into some kind of an aeroplane and bursting through. You know, they went to a different realm. They are in a different realm. So that's what the realm means. If they could refine that further and get to an extremely subtle, a totally, totally subtle realm where they have no attachment and no interest even in any of the objects of the senses, nothing, they would reach a realm called the formless realm, mentally. The body is still in the desire realm. But that's what the three realms are. They're really just three differing levels of of caring about the objects of the senses or being attached to certain objects mentally. They are very, very unattached by the time they get to the formless realm. Their mind can be in that realm. And they mistake that for nirvana. They mistake that for a goal. Because it feels very good. It feels very good. What's happening to your body as your mind is in those realms? It's deteriorating by nature. It's always deteriorating. Moment by moment goes on. Even while this person is sitting in this meditation on this extremely subtle level, sooner or later they gotta come out, they have to poop, they have to eat, they have to walk here and there. You're stuck in this realm. I mean, they're stuck in suffering anyway. So from a causal point of view, meaning no matter what kind of meditation you could get into, which is just like a mindless meditation, your body's still here and you're still going to suffer, and when the day comes to die, all that nice, pretty meditation stuff doesn't mean anything. And even these handsome or smart or intelligent or good meditating people will still get arthritis, and they'll still get stupid, and they'll still lose their hearing, and they'll eventually die. And then where they go from there is another thing. So it's not a... To travel between the three realms is no big deal. You might as well stay in a realm where you can study and think clearly and try to get out of the three realms. It's a different story. So all three of these realms are suffering, and you have to be careful not to get sucked into thinking. And it's just logical. You don't have to be a genius, you know. While you're in meditation, your body's deteriorating. And sooner or later, it will suck you back into your body, and you'll die, and it's all meaningless. So we take that as a dangerous condition, yeah.
What does happen to the consciousness?
It's a great question. It's very relevant. It's very relevant. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it today. Desire realm basically has... We're going to concentrate on the desire realm just for a second. So if you had a homework question that said, what separates the one realm from another, it's basically the subtlety of your consciousness. How subtle is your consciousness? You know, if your consciousness is now unattached or disattached, unconnected from gross desire objects, you know, food, sex, job, stuff like that, and you cut yourself off, your mind actually moves to a higher plane. And then if you can cut your mind off from desire for all physical objects, period, you'd be in the desire in the formless realm, your mind. Your mind would move to the formless plane. So that's why they are cons. What separates them is relative subtlety of your mind. And the way you move up each level within there's many levels, is that you get unattached to a new object. Like suppose at a very low level in the form realm, you become unattached to smells and tastes. Like if you're attached to food, you're pretty much stuck in the desire realm. The minute you overcome that and you're no longer much attached to food, your mind is pretty close to reaching a form realm sort of attitude. Is it a great goal? No. But we'll talk about that later. Is it a great goal to be a glutton? No. I mean, no. And it's a modern problem that we don't address. But that's another thing. So, Dukkha. Dukkha basically has, you can divide it into 20 different sectors. Okay? 20 different parts of the Dukkha. Starting from the bottom, there are 8 different kinds of hells. Hells are basically divided into cold hells, hot hells. Can I show them to you? No. Did the Buddha ever take anybody there? Yes. The Wheel of Life was painted by a student of the Buddha. He took him to the hells. He didn't believe in the hells. The Buddha, under certain conditions, a person can take you there. Much like Dante was taken by Virgil. And it's very interesting because the descriptions are extremely similar. So we'll get into that and we'll discuss why it's possible that they exist. You know, in Buddhism, you're supposed to be rational. You're not supposed to accept anything that someone says just because they said it. I can get up here and say there's 9 hells, you wouldn't know the difference. I'm supposed to be able to prove it to you logically that it's logical that such a place could exist. And we'll get into that. You don't have to accept it otherwise. Be aware that all great Buddhist saints or enlightened people have perceived these hells and described them. But we'll go farther than that. We'll even try to establish their existence to some extent.
There's a thing called a preta in Sanskrit. People call these hungry ghosts.
I just don't like the word ghost. It reminds me of Casper, you know. So I like to call it craving spirits. They're not just hungry, they're thirsty, they have other problems. Okay. But their main quality of them is that they're craving something. They have this thirst, this hunger, this dissatisfaction that drives them. Can you see them? No. Can I prove that they exist? And by the way, in Buddhist logic, the existence of these is an example of something that a Buddhist cannot get up and assert unless they can prove it. Now, I can't get up and say, pretas exist for you, unless I can give you some proof for it. Because you can't see them. They have a physical form. They might exist in this room. You can't see them. It's a kind of a very subtle physical form. You can't see them. We can establish logically that they could exist, but I can't stand up here and tell you that, you know, there's all these predators around and you're just stupid and you didn't see them, you know. You have to stay in the realm of proof in Buddhism. Animals, this is the first realm that we can see. And we'll go through that realm. I mean, we'll talk about each of the realms during this course. The specific sufferings of each of the realms. Westerners have this sort of, what do you call it? Glorified conception of animals, you know, like animals, bunny rabbits getting along with each other, and you know, nice whales communicating with each other underwater, and dolphins, you know, and I mean, that's your conception of animals. The Buddhist conception of animals is a horrifying realm of sheer terror, that animals are spending their entire existence 24 hours a day with no rest, of looking over their shoulder for the next animal up. You know, that their whole existence is defined. They exist only to be eaten by other animals or to be destroyed by other animals. Their whole existence is this horrible terror of trying to get away from the animal that's supposed to eat them. And everybody's in a food chain. You know, somewhere in the food chain you're there. And you spend your whole being is aimed at trying to escape and trying to stay safe. And they can't. And normally they're eaten by some other animal or killed by some other animal. And then the ones who are encountered human beings are tortured on top of that. And made to do incredible work and taken advantage of and exploited and then finally killed. Or else they're just raised and killed for their flesh or their skin or their horns or whatever it is. So in Buddhism it's a very depressing realm of dog eat dog and nothing romantic at all. Next one up is humans. They divide humans into the four continents. And we'll talk more about that. Okay. We'll talk about the four realms of human beings. Next we have what they're called, sometimes they call them gods. The Sanskrit word is deva. The Tibetan word is pa. And the capital of Tibet is Fata, which some stupid British guy misspelled. It's really supposed to be this. Seriously, okay? It's Los Angeles. It's the city of the angel, okay? Sa means city or place, and Pa means angels and whatever. There's two kinds of Pa's in the world, two kinds of Devas. The same word is used to describe beings who are totally enlightened, like these beings, Tara, a female Buddha here, totally enlightened, totally pure, totally enlightened. Used to be like us, studied nicely, meditated nicely, became totally different. Outside of all the realms, in a totally different place. That's one meaning of Pa. And you could call it deity or god or angel, I don't know. I don't think we have a very good word anymore. There are other kind of Pa's which are inside of suffering. And they're just another realm of suffering. So I prefer to give them a different name. They are distinguished by spending their whole existence in some kind of worldly pleasures. Like a super Donald Trump or something. And I prefer to call them pleasure beings. You can't see them. They exist in this world or they exist in a higher place. It's maybe like when you think of Greek gods, you know, the Greek gods sitting up there, sending down rain when they feel like it, you know, having these momentous struggles between each other, and then finally dying some horrible death. That's pretty much the existence of a pleasure being. The word is the same as the word for these enlightened beings, but they're a totally different kind of beings. They're worldly beings. So how much does that come up to? Oh, sorry. I have to tell you there's six of them. Six different types in the desire realm. The form and formless realm are also populated by thoughts, and not by any of these other beings. Okay, the form and formless realm are occupied by thoughts also. But in the desire realm, which is our subject right now, there are six different types of thoughts. So if you 6, 10, 11, 12, 20. Okay. We'll talk about it today. We'll get there. So those are basically, that's the desire realm. That's the structure of the desire realm. Okay. We'll do form realm real fast, then we'll take a break. And then you'll come back to the formless realm. There's four levels to the formless realm. As you go up, more and more subtle. So in what we call Samdhin Dhamma, which is the first level, has within it three different sections. The Samdhin Nipa has three different sections. Samdhin Sumpa has three different sections. Samdhin Shipa has eight different sections. So the form realm consists of how many sections? 17 different sections. Okay, what's the big deal? Who cares? Okay. It's interesting because the form realm is called the result of meditation. It's called Jivin Yomju, which means this is a result of meditation, which gives you a clue as to why there are 17 different sections to the form realm. You know, what determines if you're going to reach the form realm or not? It all depends on if you're like one of those people in India, like a Hindu meditator, you spent much of your life in deep meditation. You overcame the desire for the object of the senses. Your mind is disengaged and not attached anymore. And you've reached this ability to almost simultaneously get into a state of deep meditation where you have no awareness of the objects of the senses, no interest in them. And you have no attachment, especially to food or smells or any kind of sensual things. And you've reached this kind of meditative purity where you're free of that. Your mind is in the form realm. Then when that body dies, that mind and that person takes birth in the form realm. Okay. In the form realm, they have a regular body up, but it's a very, like a wonderful kind of body. And they live there for supposedly millions of years in those bodies. And they just enjoy themselves. They have wonderful things going on. They have the ability to emanate objects and then enjoy them. Like I could emanate 10 girlfriends and enjoy all those girlfriends, and then they could become 20, and then and if you reach a higher level, someone else can enjoy your emanations. You know, you can say, hey, watch these emanations. You emanate these, and then this other person can. So there are all these levels of incredible ability to emanate things and then enjoy them, and other people can emanate things with your emanations, and you can mix up your emanations, you can join with each other. And they have this incredible ability. And that's like a physical body. And then in that realm, the whole place is defined by beauty. So that's why it's the form realm. The form realm is characterized by just being incredibly beautiful. I sometimes think the Christian idea of heaven might have come from this realm. I don't know, you know. But unfortunately, you don't stay there permanently. We'll talk about that. Okay. It's a kind of realm you get to by the power of meditating, because the power of that meditation in the form realm in the life before causes you to take birth in this realm in the next life. By the way, you can only get to this realm by doing very good things in your life, by having almost not done any bad deeds in your whole life. And in fact, meditation at a certain level is called a samaya, a vow. It protects you. It's like a monk's vow or a bodhisattva vow that you've kept. Why? I mean, what is it about meditation that would prevent you from doing killing, stealing, lying, slander, harsh words, idle gossip, like craving, ill will, and what's wrong with you?
You can't do it.
You're too busy. I mean, if you're deep in meditation, you can't kill anybody. You can't lie. And so just by default, So actually in the Abhidharma, the fact of being in deep meditation is called a kind of a vow, because it protects you from doing bad deeds. So these people who in this life, in the life before, were in deep meditation much of their life and died that way, you know, died with their mind with that kind of imbued with that kind of a peace, are born in this realm. If they don't have, you know, if they were sort of disengaged from all those objects, they get born in the first level of the first form realm section. And then if it goes up, 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 up until you get up to here. Okay? And those are all the different levels. The highest level up here is called Old Min. I just bring that up because there's another Old Min, which is a pure place, which is a Buddha paradise. And so there's a worldly Old Min, which is like up here, which is a very high level in the form realm. And then there's a different Old Min, which is a totally pure Buddha paradise. So I don't want you to get confused. I used to get confused. So I'm trying to anticipate that as you study more Buddhism, you'll hear somebody like the Dalai Lama say, well, he came from Old Min paradise. You say, well, what's the big deal? That's in the form realm. I say, no, that's the other Old Min. Okay, so there's two Old Min. That might be on your homework, okay? The paradise is called... Paradise has an extra name attached here often, Old Min Tupo Kurpa. And it means something like varied forms or beauty. It just refers to the beauty of that Buddha paradise. What's the difference between a Buddha paradise and a regular old form realm paradise? You don't die, you don't age, you don't have suffering. Okay? These beings don't have the obvious suffering that we have. I mean, they don't go through getting cancer. They don't go through a lot of the sufferings that we go through. But they definitely... The story here is that you live millions of years, or hundreds of thousands of years, and all you do is enjoy yourself. You know, you can imagine, like, in this very, very high plane of mental meditation, you enter that life with that same kind of mind that you had in your past life. So it's a very subtle state of mind. It's like being a really good computer programmer and never coming out of it. You know, you spend all your time in cyberspace, and everything is beautiful, and you never have to come back and eat, you know, or drink coffee. You're just living there, and everything is very beautiful, and you're exchanging emanations with other devas, and you're just enjoying it. And it's like this really great existence. Now, something happens to them just before they die. Like a few days before, for the first time, they start to age. It's like in the movies where the guy ages, you know, in a few minutes he ages like 100 years and then falls apart into dust or something like that. And that supposedly that starts to happen. The process, you lose the karma. It wears out. The karma of having been so good in your past life wears out. And then you've only got bad karma left. And so within a very short period of time, you start to get very ugly. Your face starts to change, your hair falls out, you start to stink for the first time, you have perspiration for the first time. And so the other devas, what? They shun you. You know, they don't want to talk to you anymore, they don't want to... You know, you're in this beautiful club, man, and now you're ugly and old, and, you know, you don't belong there anymore. And they just avoid you. And the mental suffering that comes from those last few days is supposed to be much worse than the pleasure of all the hundreds of thousands of years before. And packed into a few short days is the suffering of being rejected by everyone in that paradise. And you just sit there and get old and start to stink, and people ignore you and run away from you when they see you, and it's just some kind of suffering. Since you've used up all your good deeds, and we'll talk about that sometime. I mean, just to have a perception of this room for the length of this class requires an incredible amount of good karma. It requires trillions of events happening at once mentally in your mind to maintain this appearance of a room on 6th Street that you're studying Dharma in. Trillions and trillions of good karmas are going off for you to stay alive in this room for the next hour or so and hear a Dharma teaching. And you're using them up like that. They've used them up like that, and then they have none left. And there's this flow chart in the scriptures where they go straight down to hell. And there's no other choice. There's never any, you know, alternate path. Just by the nature of using up all your good karma. You're using up a tremendous amount by being in this class. hopefully if you dedicate it right at the end, you get back more than that. Yeah.
You said that you have to have very good karma to go to the cells and you must not hurt anyone.
Yeah.
So before that, you must have done something.
Right. Because there's three levels of maturation of karma. One is in this life, one is in the next life, and one is in all lives beyond that. So you must have been bad karma of the third type.
So you were referring to the life just before being reborn in the formless life.
Yeah. No, that karma was probably very excellent. The karma prior to that was probably better. Was definitely better.
That's the form realm. I think I covered anything there. So you have a causal form realm and you have a resulting form realm.
What it means is the state of meditation that you're engaging in this life is the cause of that realm. And then, because your mind is in that realm, as you die, you transfer over into that realm. You take on a new physical body, but your mind is still in this deep state of community, of meditation. And your existence there is very subtle and very enjoyable.
Where is the realm where you, as less than an enlightened being, go and study Dharma and everything's Dharma? Is that, what paradise is that?
Normally they say that the human realm, the plain old desire realm, is best for Dharma study. Because we have a very desirable mix of suffering and happiness. Like you have enough happiness to imagine what it would be like to be in a real paradise. You know, we are allowed some glimpses of what it would be to be truly blissful. And those are some kind of pre-sign of what paradise could be like. We can imagine, in our realm, people like you and me can imagine paradise. We can imagine what it would be like. So we have, on the one hand, we have enough of that part of our life that we can imagine and work to these paradise. But on the other hand, we have enough crap. You know, we have enough bad things happening to us that we can definitely want to leave this kind of existence. So they say that the desire realm is an excellent realm to study Dharma. Because on one hand, you can get some sense of what bliss would be like. And on the other hand, you definitely know how bad life is, and how everything eventually deteriorates in this life. And so you can be driven to reach that. Two quick questions, then we're going to take a break. We got two classes in one tonight.
Well, isn't there enough suffering in the form realm, in those final moments that other beings witness, that they would say, this is really awful, and then suffering that...
They don't get it. I mean, go to a football game, there's 60,000 people. go to a Dharma study, you know, I don't know how many people come. It's just the fact that humans are blind to their own condition. They choose to ignore it, or they want to ignore it. That's just the fact. Yeah.
Isn't it possible that some great Buddhist meditator meditates so hard that he ends up in the form realm and doesn't go to hell afterwards? That's
a Buddha?
No, someone.
Or some great being?
Someone who just
spends
most of his life in Buddhist meditation, but I mean, so it is possible to not go to hell, to somehow just
remotely, but they say that's pretty much a locked in.
One more. I wanted to restate my question. They say there are these paradises where you go when you're not fully enlightened, and everything is Dharma, and you
when
study
you become, Dharma. When you reach a certain bodhisattva level, you can go to a paradise like that and study with a Buddha. Is it like you get in a plane and go to this place and, you know... No, it's not like that. It's all taking place mentally.
Outside the desire realm?
You're in the desire realm, he's in a Buddha paradise. How's that? That's the emptiness of that paradise. You cannot experience it as a Buddha paradise. You're not capable. You're experiencing it as a very cool place where this Buddha is talking to you. You know, but the Buddha is experiencing it as a totally different place. I mean, it applies to the store of history, okay?
Sure.
I mean, different people could have totally different perceptions of this room.
And it's not one of the four realms. It's not.
And you could be sitting in there with a Buddha, and he's experiencing it as a Buddha paradise, and you're experiencing it as this lousy little, you know, room.
I just wonder what that's classified as. That's
Definitely outside of samsara. But you, it's a big debate in the monastery. We debate this hours and hours. If you're a bodhisattva sitting in that Buddha paradise, you're not in a Buddha paradise. But you can't experience it as a Buddha paradise. You're not enlightened yet. So that's not a contradiction at all. It's what I started out saying tonight. two different people can have two valid perceptions of the same object, which are totally contradictory. And in fact, that's the way we live. It causes a lot of conflict in the world because of the different perceptions of one person or one object. I have to take a break, have some tea, then we'll do the formless realm real quick, okay? Say, Namka Taye.
Namka Taye.
Namshe Taye.
Namshe Taye.
Chiyangme.
Chiyangme.
Sitte.
Sitte.
Okay. Those are the four levels of the formless realm. Okay? How do you get born in the formless realm? Yeah, even more subtle than the former. So in this life, you know, if a person who can regularly put their mind in the form realm is rare, a person who can regularly put their mind in the formless realm is extremely rare. I mean, I don't know if there's anybody in India out there who could do it. But anyway, it would be someone who could put their mind into that level of meditation where they are totally disengaged from all objects of the senses and even from the very, very subtle desirable objects, and their mind is at a very, very, very subtle level. And that subtle level, after you die, if you can maintain it, then you take birth in the formless realm. Where is the formless realm? I mean, basically, wherever you die is where you enter the formless realm. Okay, there's no place. Because as the book, as one book says, in a sense, it's the form that would separate places. We can say that the form realm is at a certain level above this world, but the formless realm, there's no place. Wherever you die, you take birth in the formless realm, and that's where your formless realm is. And the beings there have no body. Okay? They have no body. They're just mind. And we'll talk about it. How do you think you could get to four different parts of the formless realm? If you wanted to get to formless level number two, how could you get there? Yeah, different levels of meditation in this life. So, I mean, if you got up to a second level of formless realm meditation in this life, and then died, and could maintain something of that state of mind, your mind would take birth in that second level of formless realm. What are the names of these? These are the resulting levels, okay? These are the levels where you go after you die. There's four levels of meditation before you die. We're not going to worry about it, okay? Nanga means space. Taye means limitless. So this first level is called limitless space. And that gives you some idea of the state of mind there. It describes the state of meditation there. It's a kind of samadhi, and it's called limitless space. Namshe Taye, here's the same word, limitless. And Namshe means consciousness or awareness. So what's the difference between limitless space and limitless awareness? I don't know. I suppose you'll know if you ever get there, okay? Chiyangme means nothing at all. Okay? Nothing at all. But it describes a kind of concentration. It describes a kind of spaced out state of mind. Okay? By the way, this was also the name of a kind of meditation which was, what do you call it? It was a monk from China in the 8th century called Huashang came to Tibet and tried to teach a meditation called Qiyangme. He was a proponent of a meditation called Qiyangme. And this is not part of this class tonight, but just so you know, there's a word called Qiyangme, and that was the meditation that he said people should do. And it was to sit down and put your mind on nothing at all. And if you achieved it at some point, that was emptiness, and you had achieved nirvana, if you could think of nothing at all. And there was an Indian master called Kamarasimha, who debated him in the court of the king of those days. And that viewpoint, which is pretty much would just get you to this realm, was banned in Tibet, and he was sent home. Okay? And it never came back to Tibet. That idea that you should just sit down and meditate on nothing, and that is some kind of important spiritual goal, while your body clock is ticking away, and you're going to, as you die, it's going to drag you back down into the desire realm, and you're going to die like that. I mean, big deal. You know, so it was rejected by the Tibetans after hearing each viewpoint debated for a long, I think it took a couple of weeks actually. So don't do a Qiyangme, okay? Sitte, Sitte means cyclic life. It's a synonym for samsara even. Sitte means suffering existence. Sitte means the peak, peak level. In other words, of all the levels in suffering existence, this is the highest. There's a very common phrase in the scriptures which says, all the way from being in hell, upside down on a chain, hung over a pot of boiling steel, and all the way up to this very, very rarefied mental state, it's all the same. There's no difference. Everybody's suffering. It's not a big deal whether you're just got into a fiery car accident or you're sitting quietly in ashram somewhere and meditating on sitte and your mind is at a very sudden level. Just say it's all the same. You're suffering. You're suffering equally. So don't get caught. Don't get caught by that idea. To put your mind into that level and stay there while you're getting old and dying, you might as well be in hell. It's the same thing. Same kind of suffering of aging and dying. We actually want to find some practice that can get us out of that. And it's not just putting your mind on focusing on nothing or watching your thoughts go by or something like that.
Would you comment on the third level referred to all Zen sects?
I don't know Zen. No, my impression of Zen is that it's really good to learn to concentrate. And then as certain good students are doing, go get the theoretical basis behind emptiness and everything else, and then use them together. You know, I think that's okay. I think if it's only thinking about nothing, or if it's only watching your thoughts, then you can see the result. I mean, this is where it would go. This is the result. And it's in all the scriptures, it's described like that, in the original scriptures. This is from, you can look it up in sutras. You know, and it's that state of mind of just blanking out, trying to think about nothing. It does not perform the desired function of bringing you to nirvana, of reaching the escape from suffering. It's just another, it's a very subtle form of suffering. Is there a question?
Yeah, I had a question.
Okay.
Are we on that feeling that these are all higher and higher levels of
self-good temptation? Yeah, they are.
These
anywhere, right? Excuse me? Oh, by the way, the only one you have to get to is the first, is the introductory form of the first level of the former. What I mean is, your goal as a Buddhist practitioner who needs to see emptiness directly in order to free oneself from suffering, which is the only way. You can only see that based on the platform of a certain part of the first former. So yeah, you do have to learn to get up to that mentally. You'll be disengaged from objects of the senses, basically. And you won't have much attachment to them. And you'll be able, in meditation, it would be described in our country as an incredible ability to meditate. And you would actually, your mind on the platform of the first form realm level, the introductory part of the first form realm, can be focused enough to see emptiness directly. If you can't get your mind up to that level, you will never see emptiness directly. If you don't practice daily, you will never get up to that level. So, it's very simple. If you never want to see emptiness directly, don't meditate daily. Which is the case for most of us, you know. And you say you don't have time or some excuse, and the day you die will seem like a ridiculous mistake, you know. It's actually the only activity that's very meaningful is to try to do that. You have to dedicate some part of your time to doing that. To get to that level in meditation to where you could see emptiness directly, you must do it at least like an hour a day. If you don't, then there's no chance. You'll never see emptiness directly. You disqualified yourself. So it's very important to get to that. But not important to do it as a practice, where that's all you want to do is clear your mind out and think about nothing. Because the result is qigong or sitte or some other number like that.
So I guess you can answer it, but the meditation that you're saying that you need to do every day is qigong.
No. It's way down in the form realm, first level form realm. Sometimes I'm wrong.
But what would be the practice?
No use to get up to qigong. No great use for it. I mean, sometimes people would do it in order to just hone their concentration. There's a practice called dancing. You know, you jump to one level, go to the next one, skip down two, go back to the third. Just to prove that you have the ability to concentrate at those levels.
But then what particular meditation are you talking about?
It's a kind of a meditation where you bring your mind up to the first form realm, which we described earlier.
The process and
method is... Oh, long story. We had a whole course on it. We did a 3-3-month course on it. There's a monk from this place who's going to that at the open center. He started last night, and we're going to do more of those things. It's Kamala Shiva's presentation. And he's really inspired by Kamala Shiva. So you could get a taste of it if you go there, you won't get off.
The correspondence course.
He said that we have it as a correspondence course. If you like, if you want to take it between classes or something, you can get the tapes and you can go through it. Correspondence course is not absolutely not the same as a human being, and our lineage says that it very much discourages that kind of thing. But I think in America, if you don't, you know, there's no choice. And if no one's going to have that course for another 5 years, then you might die between. might as well.
Michael, what is the relationship in those? And do you go through steps from one to another, or?
These are four results, four levels at which you can take birth. Your mind takes birth, disembodied. If you meditate on four kinds of meditation, I'll give you the. I think this is on your homework. Okay. That's how I get people to pay attention towards the end of class. Not conceptual and not non-conceptual. Okay? It's called Du Shen Min. It's that first level, formless realm meditation in this life. Your body's in the desire realm, your mind is at an extremely subtle level called not conception and not non-conception either. Yeah?
So, this realm, if your body is the physical body in the desire realm,
yes.
So this going through this realm is actually part of what is practiced, but you're not supposed to expect it, or you can just skip beyond it. And
there's no need in Buddhist practice to go to get to other realms this realm.
So you can actually attain full enlightenment without ever going to this realm within your practice.
Yeah.
And you're not okay.
Yeah. To get to the first of the four realms. Causal meditation.
So it's not like it's a...
No, it's not a goal.
Not a goal, but like a stage you go through now.
No. There is some practices where you skip between them just to practice meditating. Sort of build up your meditation muscle.
So this method, this meditation that you're talking about are not non-Buddhist meditations?
They are. I mean, mostly they were practiced in India by deep meditators.
So why would they be in Buddhist...
We're just describing, if you want to get to this realm and suffer there, this is how you can do it. Well, we have to cover all the realms, you know. Otherwise you might think, oh, you know, I heard the formless realm was okay. You know. If you meditate on this is a causal meditation in this life, and this is the result, state of mind, in the next life. If you use this kind of meditation, you'll get born here. Your mind will be there when you die. So you get from this meditation, you go to limitless space. Now, fortunately, with the other three, the names of the causal meditations in this life are the same as the names of the place where you're born. So that's easy. Just repeat, okay?
What's the name in English?
This one was limitless space, right? This one is limitless awareness. This one is nothing at all. And this one is peak existence. And it's in your reading, I think. You've got it straight from the Abhidharma. No, that's not your reading. First dilemma never coming down. You have to go to a Sakya commentary from the 1200s. But it's there. I just want to make sure I covered everything in your homework. The homework says, what provides the basis for the stream of the mind in the formless realm? In other words, how can you have a disembodied mind? How can a mind exist without a body to live on? And they go into a long description of that. I mean, it's a natural question. If you say, when I die, my mind is just floating there, well, doesn't there have to be any kind of physical basis or some kind of basis to support the mind, the stream of the mind? And there's a big debate in the Abhidharma system. Basically, they say two things. One is the continuum of the person. By the way, is the person physical or mental?
What did you say?
Yes. Actually not. That was Michael Roach's physical amendment.
Michael Roach.
Neither.
Neither.
I have both. I have a body and a mind. But I, the concept I, is something which is neither mental nor physical. It's the concept. It does exist, the persona. You know, the personality. It exists, but it's not my mind and it's not my body. It's what owns the mind and the body. And that's the first answer in the Abhidhamma system. The mind stays on the continuation of the being. Stays on Brahma. The mind is based on the person, which is neither physical nor mental in and of itself. John. What's John? John's an idea. I mean, John's a concept. John has a body and John has a mind, but John is a concept. So that continuation of that persona is what the mind sticks to. In one presentation, and the second one is the life energy. The mind is feeding, is based on life energy. Life energy is continuing from the death into the birth in that realm, and it's life on which the mind is riding. The life energy itself. Another part of that school says karma. Another part of that school says five different other things, which you can read here. But basically, the Abhidhamma school is very big on the existence of things which are neither physical nor mental, like your impermanence. The fact of your impermanence is not your body and not your mind. It's a condition. And they're very big on that. And that would carry your mind. So that's a little difficult. Yeah, I can do that. what distinguishes the formless realm from the ocean realms? Basically, the subtlety. And the fact that beings in those realms, and this is the way all the realms are defined, have their own special hangups. They have their own special mental afflictions. They get afflicted about their mind. You know, they are getting jealous or desire, mainly desire, about their mind. They are having the same problems we have, but they are much, much more subtle. Very subtly attached to their own mind. Because that's all they have left. Right? Name the five types of birth that a person can take. Yeah, they can think of each other. They do have some, I believe, as it's described, as I remember, they have, by that level of concentration, you have some kind of ESP, some clairvoyance. You're able to hear other people's thoughts.
Yeah,
they have what's called Pai Chen, a Deva Eye, you know, which is actually just a level of concentration where you can read other people's thoughts. Five types of birth, that comes right after the formless realm in the Abhidhamma. And I'll just go through the rest of these questions fast. Basically, you know them already. Hell. What's the next one?
Craving
spirit.
Animals.
So three bad ones. We call three below those. And then?
Humans.
And? Devas. Okay. So there are five ways you can take rebirth. There's only five ways you can take rebirth. Okay. Now there's a debate that we do in the monastery. You know, are there any kind of living beings that are not included in the five ways you can take
rebirth?
Yeah.
No.
What? Mind beings. Sentient meaning unenlightened beings who still have mind.
Part of beings.
Okay. Part of beings, those beings between rebirths don't fit in any of those five. So if you're ever in Sarah Monastery and you're debating somebody, you know.
Did you win this debate? Did you lose this debate?
You know.
Isn't there a realm
for
us?
Yeah, that's one of the questions actually. It's coming here. We'll do it right now. They're included in, there's a debate about it. Basically, Asanga's position is that they're included in the pleasure beings. There's a kind of being called, sometimes they call them demigods. They're asuras in Sanskrit. In Tibetan, Hamani, and in each case they use a negative particle. And that means not that they're not a deva, but they are inferior devas. So beings slightly less glorious than their cousins, the full devas, what is their major mental affliction? When you're not quite as good as someone else, then your normal affliction of your mind, which I know as well, and we all know, is jealousy. So their lives are consumed by jealousy. And but because of they're so similar to full days, they're included in the difference. Last thing here, last subject, is four ways of taking birth. We're actually out of the presentation of three realms, we're kind of going a little bit further than that. The four ways of taking birth taught in the scriptures. First one is called Zuke. Say Zuke.
Zuke.
Zuke means miracle, or magic, or something like that. Zuke means to be born. Some people call it miraculous birth. To me, it's too close to the Virgin Mary already. So, the point is that you take birth totally complete. Like, Pantasambhava was supposed to be that. You just suddenly appear in that place as an adult, usually clothed. And you're just there. You just pop up in that place. You're totally finished. I like to call it finished birth or something like that. You know, the minute you enter that birth, you're already completely finished. According to Buddhist scripture, the first beings on the planet are born like that. We'll go through it, it's very beautiful. The end of this chapter in Yamadao describes the end of the world. And the sun goes into a supernova. And it burns up, the planet melts. And all the beings on this planet die. And they don't have the karma yet to not to be in the realm that they're in. Like if you're in hell and the whole planet is dissolved, you have to go somewhere. So they suddenly appear like being beamed down to another planet, totally the way they were before. And just to finish their karma is such that they appear as a finished being immediately, already complete. Like, devas don't have to go through a birth process. There's no mommy devas who are going through the suffering and having a baby, if they don't have that kind of suffering. The babies appear in the last of the mother's kiss. Supposed to be. Yeah.
So
is Pantasambhava
not an enlightened being?
Well, he isn't an enlightened being, but it's a similar thing of him appearing thing. It's true he didn't go through one of the four samsaric
But you wouldn't apply this to an emanation?
No. Zuke. Second one is called Trushevakyo. Trushevakyo means, in the Middle Ages in Europe they call it spontaneous generation, which is from heat. It means to be born from warmth and moisture. And that's where, like, in a certain kind of, I think we recognize it to be tiny eggs, like a mosquito. And certain, you know, when the flies come out in the spring, the temperature gets to a certain warmth, and there's a pool of water, and suddenly there's these baby insects popping up. That's called Trushevakyo.
Is that what they were referring to?
I believe it is. I mean, that's the example they often give, you know. That summer starts to come, and then suddenly there's all these bugs around. Mm-hmm. And it must be Trushevakyo. But I don't know. We got to talk about that. Maybe it means eggs to a certain tiny egg. I don't know. Next one is Nyauke. Nyauke means birth from a womb. And human beings are an example of Nyauke. The last kind of birth is the gonke. Gonke means birth from an egg, like a chicken egg.
Would you make it to bed before?
I don't think we have time actually. You want it? You need one? I'll do it in talk, how's that? If you read the reading that you're getting tonight, you'll see that it says, it goes through how human beings, for example, have all of these kinds of births. And you just have to, I mean, they're going to quote ancient histories of beings that were born from eggs and things like that. This sounds a little funny. I won't go through it.
I mean, there is such a thing, medically, as calcification in utero.
No, that's
serious.
What does it mean? Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. That's the Tibetan. Which type of birth is considered better than others? They go through this long thing in the Abhidhamma. Zuke is better than, each one is better than the rest. Why? They say Zuke only doesn't hurt anybody. I mean, if you just appear someplace, it doesn't hurt your mom, it doesn't hurt you. Trushevakyo doesn't hurt anybody else, but it's sort of painful for yourself.
Okay.
Which is that spontaneous birth from heat and wetness. Nyauke hurts your mother, and it's, well, some scriptures explain it, that it hurts yourself once. Because it hurts like hell to come out. And then Gonke hurts your mother once and you twice. So,
where's Gonke?
Verse 7 and 8. I don't know why it's right. I guess once as you're bursting out, and maybe once when you pop out. I don't know.
Once you hatch.
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's when you're laid, it somehow hurts you to be laid. I mean, it hurts. That's it. They say that the desirability of birth goes like that. Also, by the way, the frequency is something like that. Zukis are much more frequent. If I was right, yeah, something like that. Meaning, I mean, when a planet is destroyed, you've got jillions of beings zukiing on another planet. That's another story. You just pop up in hell. You stop breathing here, and possibly within a few seconds, all you're experiencing is this chaos where the ground is burning red hot and all people are very smashing at you with things for millions of years.
There's no other process.
And it's quite possible. But we have to discuss why, and I don't expect you to go home and, I don't know. Anyway. Okay, this is one. I put in one second thing, which is, comes from the end of this chapter, which is some beings know where they're going to take birth. Now, you often hear people ask you, how can you know where you're going to take birth? Can you know that? There's the end of the third chapter of the Abhidhamma describes four different levels of awareness as you take birth, and it distinguishes between entering the womb, staying in the womb, and coming out of the womb. In other words, being aware in an adult way of what's going on during those three processes. You know, is it possible to enter the womb knowingly? And is it possible to know what's going on while you're there? And is it possible to remember as you come out, you know, hey, I used to be so-and-so, and as they go through that. So they say that, let me see if I get it straight. Wheel Empress. Do you know what a Chakravarti is? Wheel Empress? I mean, this is somebody who has got such powerful good karma that they become automatically president of the world. You know? And normally by popular consent. I mean, everybody's saying, John McCain, you ought to be president of the world, you know? Why don't you go, we'll make you a palace, and please be our president, you know? And the whole world unanimously wants, you have this karma that they all love you, and they want you to be the president of the world. And that's basically what a Chakravarti is. So people who are, by the way, the Buddha supposedly turned down that in his search for enlightenment. He had the chance, and he said, no, I want something better. You know, so those kind of beings have such powerful karma that as they enter the womb, they know what's going on. They all, in a sense, they are aware of entering the womb. And there's a kind of thing called an arhat, called a self-made arhat. They're aware of being here also. So their awareness of what's going on extends all the way into the period during the staying in the womb. And then Buddhas, according to the Abhidharma system, are aware of coming out. They're aware of the whole process. And people born from eggs aren't aware of anything. So those are the four possibilities, okay? According to the Abhidharma. There is a debate in the Abhidharma, why would a Buddha choose to go through being born through a womb if it gives his mother pain, or her mother, and if it's such a dirty way to be born? Why didn't the Buddha just appear fully finished? You know, why did he choose to be born like another human being? And then that's the best answer in the scriptures is that, well, he wanted to. According to Mahayana, he went through this whole thing as a big charade to teach people. You know, he wanted us to think that he was just like us.
And so he went through this whole thing of going into his mother's womb and coming out of his mother's womb and going back down. So
that's one of them. Also, he came out of his body or something.
Yeah, well, cesarean.
That's the formless realm. I mean, that covers the three realms.
Most people don't teach this chapter because a lot of what I said tonight is unacceptable to a modern, you know, thinking person. But you can, I think it's important to be aware of the, especially the meditation parts, the form realm and the formless realm, to where you don't get into the thing of meditating just to be thinking about nothing. I think you can see the possible problem of that. You don't have to accept it completely tonight, but you can see the possible problem of getting into a spiritual practice where you just sit down and count your breaths for the rest of your life, or watch your thoughts for the rest of your life, or try to think about the luminosity of the mind, meaning that your mind is aware. You know, concentrating on the awareness of your mind are all considered in the original teachings of Buddhism, which you can read. You have the readings to be just an error and not to... It might be useful, like if you have a problem with being nervous, that you did one of these meditations just so you get calmed down enough to do the right kind of meditation. You know what I mean? But in and out of itself, as a Buddhist practice, not desirable. I mean, it's not a goal. It could be that you develop extraordinary abilities of concentration in order to focus on other important spiritual objects like emptiness or impermanence or visualizations that could help you become enlightened. But as in and of themselves, they are not a spiritual path that's desirable. Yeah.
Are you born into those realms because your mind is in that state at the moment of death?
They say that pretty much. You know, you will get just concerned at the moment of death. And I mean, people, there's this thing called talk, where supposedly at the moment of death, you finally get your act together and project your consciousness through. I mean, the odds are like infinitely against it. I mean, if you don't believe so, stand over near this window and I'll push you over, you know, and see what comes up in your mind, you know, see if you're able to concentrate on projecting your consciousness to this next word. Put you in kind of a cab, you know. I'm very serious. It's not the time to do it. If you're going to do something about directing your consciousness, you better do it while we're middle-aged, healthy, intelligent, meditating in a nice room. You know, do it now. Don't wait for that moment. You'll be too damn scared. You know, and you know that. Because if I throw you in front of a cab, you're not thinking about poem. You know?
Yeah.
It's like you want to see something with a microscope, but the goal is not to have a microscope. It's a tool. I mean, you're trying to see a virus or something, but you don't get attached to holding a microscope anymore. It's a tool that you must have to see energy misdirected. Just total purpose is that. It's all behind that. One more question, you want to
stop. Yeah, in a way, I'm trying to undermine what you said, but isn't this power that is supposed to be like autopilot? Like you should do martial arts or play an instrument, you almost didn't think of what you're doing. Like in a situation, you respond completely mechanically, not to the impulse training.
Yeah,
so
ideally.
When you actually fall down out of the window, the autopilot turns in and you...
Yeah. Ideally, but your mind is...
very difficult.
They call it the domino collapse. It's like the mind is... the elements of your mind are collapsing. It's like being on... someone gives you LSD. You know, it's not only that you're scared, you know, your mind itself is collapsing. The ability to think, the synapses are short-circuiting, and you're hallucinating, and you don't know where you are or what's going on. Yeah, that's the idea. But much, much better to do definitely from now. The mind is... the elements of your mind are collapsing. It's like being on... someone gives you LSD. You know, it's not only that you're scared, you know, your mind itself is collapsing. The ability to think, the synapses are short-circuiting, and you're hallucinating, and
and there's just horrible things going on. You're totally disconcerted. You don't know where you are or what's going on. Yeah, that's the idea. But much, much better to do definite thinking now. While you're healthy, thinking, smart, seeing things directly, reasonable enough. You know, then you can... So Papa says, if you know a guy's going to come and beat your brains out in the next 3 days, get ready now. I mean, you don't know which day, but you know he's going to do it. Well, start looking over your shoulder now. Don't wait until it happens. It's normally too late. We're such an extraordinary case. But now while you're healthy, you're young, you can concentrate, just work on it. And you can achieve it now. You don't have to do it. That's probably the worst time to do it. Last minute stuff.
Okay, we'll do a short prayer.
Did you cast out a hole?
No.
You don't have a hole in the room?
Yeah.
If there's anybody here who didn't come to the first class of Daniel, here's the first week's homework. I hope there's enough. And for everybody else, here's
the reading is inside, right?
I believe. Is reading number 2 in your notes?
Super.
Okay, if anybody doesn't have anything, come up to me after. Okay? Here's the homework number 2. You have to hand in both homeworks on Monday. And you'll get a quiz. You'll get 2 quizzes based on the questions from the homework. If you don't know the answer, if I didn't cover something, try to contact one of these oldest students. Try to get one of their names. It's a favorite trick of mine not to cover like 2 questions.
How about the reading?
There's reading number 1 to your panel and not to anybody who didn't get reading number 1.
No.
Just start.
We're
going to do a short prayer.
Que